rise before the sun. It's that time of year. Load up my gun, put on my gear.
Welcome back to the Healthy Hunter Show. I am Dr. Brooks Tiller. And here we go today. We have a guest from Minnesota. And he began cooking when he was 15 years old and since has become a veteran in the culinary industry. He was a sous chef of Lenny Russo's six-time James Beard-nominated Heartland Restaurant and the executive chef of the Salt Cellar and Lucia's Restaurants. And in case you don't know, James Beard Award is pretty much the World Series champion of the cooking and food world. So this guy's been at the top. He is at the top level when it comes to cooking excellent food. Now, he's most widely known as an authority on wild foods of the Midwest and his love of nose-to-tail butchery, which we're going to dive in for sure. Now, his first book, entitled Flora, which I am pumped to get my hands on next year, will be released, scheduled for spring 2021. And on his site, foragerchef.com, he shares his vast knowledge of harvesting wild food and teaching others how to prepare and cook wild food so to create amazing and delicious meals for those that we enjoy. So today's my privilege to welcome to the Healthy Hunter Show, Chef Alan Burgo. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, Brooks.
Yes, sir, man. My pleasure. So what's going good in your world right now?
Well, everything's kind of weird right now because a lot of people are staying at home with the coronavirus stuff going on. But I'm pretty lucky in that I live with my girlfriend on her family farm that's about a good 400 acres. And her whole family lives there. It's kind of an old commune that started like in the 60s. And now it's just the family. But even though we're there and we don't interact with a lot of people, I still have a lot of access to the outdoors. So I am just really blessed to have that in my life right now. So there's a lot of food coming up in my area really soon that I don't have to go to the store to get. So I'm pretty grateful for that.
Man, that's awesome. And I think that's really key right now that a lot of people realizing that the store may not have what you need, what you want, or anything to eat in some instances. And I believe that today we're going to find out a lot of good information from you about just more information about how to not have to go to the store. So I'm pretty pumped about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're going to see it. We're already seeing food shortages, I mean, in the United States. I mean, if you would ask me a couple months ago, would we ever, in my lifetime, would I ever see a food shortage? Or just a couple days ago, one of our family members went to the local co-op. The price of a single head of cauliflower was $9.
Whoa.
Okay, I've never seen anything like that in my entire life. So, you know, I can pay $9 for the cauliflower, or I can go down to the spring and harvest more pounds of watercress than I could ever eat in weeks.
Yeah.
So it's pretty interesting, you know, literally seeing a food shortage in the United States right now. So, teaching yourself about, you know, different plants and things in your area. I know a lot of your listeners are probably down in the South, and I know a number of plants down in the South that are popping right now. There's a lot of food out there that you don't have to wear a mask to a store to go and
get. I mean, just something as simple as dandelions, you know.
Absolutely.
I mean, they're everywhere. And of course, everybody's like, oh, there's dandelions in my yard, and they want to spray them. And instead, you know, I mean, maybe, you know, I mean, there's so much you can do with dandelions, salads and teas and, I mean, just all kinds of good things to do with the dandelion that's the weed that's growing in your yard.
Yeah, I mean, dandelions are a really, really super common edible and a good place to start. But they also have a pretty strong flavor, like a lot of their cousins in the same family do. So it helps to cook them in, you know, a nice big pot of salted water. And then I usually add a little bacon or some kind of fat to kind of help bring that along. But, you know, but they're an okay edible. Another really good one that I know is down where you guys are is Sochan. And that is one that the Cherokee would harvest a lot and one that I'm really looking forward to. And also poke salad or poke meat.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, I do a little bit of foraging, but it's really cool. I mean, checking out your site, reading you and a few others, and there's so much more that I step on every time I'm in the woods that I don't even realize. And, you know, and like you said, a lot of people poke salad is something they may not even recognize, but it's pretty abundant. And, you know, there's so much more that we can learn. And, you know, like you said, I mean, the dandelion can be a strong flavor, but I think everybody could agree that you throw a little bacon in, well, almost everything's edible if you throw a little bacon in.
Just about everything.
Yeah. But, you know, Al, I mean, you have a wealth of knowledge, and I want to know a little bit, how did you get involved and interested in the outdoors? Specifically, how did you get into, you know, what we call the hunting of the mushrooms or seeking out wild food? How did you get involved in that, and how did that relate and come now into your profession?
Well, it was all about my profession. So, I mean, I was in the kitchen behind the stove, you know, every working day that I could have for a solid 15 years. And eventually, you know, I'd been taught, this is how you cook and break down a chicken. This is how we break down a lamb. This is how we cook every single part of the animal. This is how we cook every vegetable that farmers can grow in our region. And then once I started getting into nicer restaurants, I started to see a wider variety of vegetables. And, you know, as one thing that's kind of like catnip to a chef is things that are very expensive and things that are hard to find, you know, that kind of scarcity, it makes people want them. And one of the most expensive things, one of the first things, was just seeing nettles come in the door. And nettles, we're buying them from some guy, like, who would have a van come through the alley and unload some nettles on us. The nettles, they were more expensive than any other product that we were buying. More expensive per pound than meat than we were buying, and any other vegetable. So that right there, now I'm interested. And then they're completely different. So it was a learning curve, you know. I'm also kind of like a sponge, and I want to constantly improve. You know, being in the kitchen, it's very similar to like the military. Like, you have an alpha male sort of complex, and you want to be the best. And one of the ways that I differentiated myself was I wanted to learn what are all these different ingredients none of my other peers are going to know, and then make something beautiful for the restaurant menu and, you know, teach myself new things. So I was really lucky in that. There's a lot of, you know, we talk about wild foods. We're now talking about botany in plants, and we're talking about mycology with mushrooms. This is a large learning curve, and it's the sort of thing that I found I could study. And I would never, it's a never-ending search and kind of quest for knowledge. So I wanted to be the best. I wanted ingredients no other chef could have. And I wanted to teach myself things. So I was really lucky in that I just got kind of spoon-fed what some of the best edibles were before I even went outside. Because, you know, I was working 12-hour shifts in a kitchen every day.
Yeah, I mean, and you talked about the botany and the actual biology of it, if you will. I mean, I remember one of my, I don't know, it was my most dreaded classes, but probably the scariest sounding class that I had in undergrad was the morphology and anatomy of vascular plants.
Yes.
And you would tell somebody that you're in that class and they are like, are you like some kind of, what are you doing to yourself? Like, what does that even mean? You know, and at first I was like, what in the world? But then my teacher takes us out, and part of one of our tests was just identifying trees on campus. You know, so we're walking, and here's a persimmon. And I was laughing whenever he challenged, he's, anybody want to take a bite of this? And somebody that knew nothing about persimmons decided they were going to take a bite.
Ooh.
I just sat in the back and chuckled, because I was like, those are not, I'm not going to eat those, but I know the deer will. And that guy took a bite. And of course, he was just spitting and foaming at the mouth for the rest of the class. But everybody else had a good laugh, you know. But like, I love what you're saying. Like, you're finding these ingredients. You know, it was kind of a personal thing. And I love how you said you're a sponge. You just soak it up. And I think that's what we all need to challenge ourselves to learn a little bit more about what's around us. And like we said, because right now, there's things in the backyard. There's things in our food plot that we could actually eat instead of just stomping on. And I think right now it's really critical that we develop that muscle of trying new things and finding new things. And what are some tips you would say, as far as if you're new to foraging, new to finding wild foods, what are some tips? Because I know, I mean, a lot of people are afraid that they're going to grab something poisonous, that you're going to grab something that's going to make them sick. So what would be a few tips that you would have as far as just getting started?
Well, to get started, I mean, I started kind of a completely backwards way, which people would probably say I started the more dangerous way, which is only partially true, because I started with mushrooms, and I did not, because the mushrooms are, they're more like sport, and plants are more like I hunt to sustain myself and to feed myself, because I eat more weight of plants than I do mushrooms or even meat. But as far as starting out, you want to look at, you know, you want to probably get some books, some literature, and there's really good simple guides for every region around the country. And that's a good place to start. But looking at pictures, and especially looking at some of the terminology in guidebooks, that is not really appealing to people, and I totally understand that, which is part of why I started writing on my website in kind of a, what I like to say is just layman's terms without a lot of, you know, Latin names and things like that that can be kind of off-putting and intimidating to people. The best way to learn plants in your area, to learn plants and mushrooms, is to go out with someone. And that is hands down the best. You know, looking at a picture, you can look at a picture all day long and look at a plant and still be nervous. But when you have an authority next to you, someone who is well known in your community, and there's a network of foragers all around the country, learning from a person hands-on, that is the best way to learn. There a couple other ones. Our online social communities are also really, really good resources. And, you know, just about everybody is on Facebook. I can guarantee you there are foraging communities on Facebook for your region down there in the South and every region across the country. There's groups for mushrooms, there's groups for plants specific to a region, and then there's big groups for the entire country. And one thing you can do is just join some of those groups. And don't just look, just watch and just see what people post. And eventually, you're going to see some repetition. You know, this isn't something that, you know, you start in a day and you're finished. It's an ongoing learning process. And it's kind of like a big edible project and a learned skill that you get to teach yourself. But looking at what people post online, you will see, eventually you will see things that people post. You're going to see them around you. And you're going to say, hey, I remember somebody posted this flower that comes from this plant, and this is in my yard right now. And they said that it was really good to eat. And those sort of things will help you build your confidence. Another really good resource that some of my peers in the foraging community really will not agree with me on is using apps. And there's a couple things to talk about, but there's a number of different plant apps. I'm going to look at the one that I have on my phone here because it is 10 out of 10 for positive IDs. And I just put it on there a couple weeks ago. It's called Picture This, and it's a free app that you can get for your phone. But all you do is you take a picture of a leaf. And like I said, 10 out of 10, the first times that I've used this thing, it's been right on with edible plants. The caveat with that is that sometimes it's wrong. And, you know, just like anything else, people online can be incorrect and you can't count on it for, you know, 1,000% ID. What it is, a plant app and being part of a community and having books, they're all just tools in the kit for building your instinctual knowledge. Because once you know a plant and once you know a mushroom, and once you've taken time and you've cooked it and you've tasted it and you've held it in your hand, you will know them at any stage in their point of growth, and you will have a sort of native knowledge that is completely lost in our society right now. And you will not forget. It'll be, I like to say, it's like going out and seeing an old friend. You know, once you really know a plant or a mushroom, you are not going to forget it. And another cool thing to mention is that children are little sponges too. And when they're young, you know, something we take for granted is that kids are close to the ground. Their point of view is a lot different than ours, and they are really, really good at memorizing plants themselves. So when they're young, it's a perfect time to start and really build these sort of, you know, healthy practices and habits that they will carry with them for their entire life. And it goes right along with, you know, harvesting meat too. One thing that you mentioned there was the word food plot. and I have a lot of friends that hunt. I have, my skill set is whole animal butchery, plant and mushroom cookery. The only firearm I own is a BB gun, and I shoot and traps. So I trap nuisance animals. I shoot pigeons. Those are things that I'll take myself. And then when the big game comes in the fall, you know, when people are going to be hunting whitetails in Wisconsin, turns into like a war zone out there, really nice deer. My friends are the ones that are going to shoot the big game. And then they call me when they want that thing processed and they want to learn how to butcher it. But kind of what the point that I'm getting to here is a lot of people, you know, we're on a quest for, you know, I want that big buck. I want the big rack. I want the trophy animal. One way to help get you there is, you know, just like tracking and learning what the animal is doing. The more plants you know and the more you know about the terrain, the better hunter you will be.
So true. So, I mean,
yeah, it's like everything is connected. Everything is connected.
Yeah. And you brought up some great points there. And one thing I was thinking about, you talking about kids, it was last year when I was out of town and my kids were staying with my parents. So they're with the grandparents' farm. And we went down to pick them up, and my dad said, "Hey, you know, like we noticed some mushrooms down there." And I was like, "Oh, you know." And he said, "Yeah." He said, "I didn't see them. He did, you know." And so my 3-year-old spotted, and he said, "Hey, Papa, there's mushrooms." And we got, and I went down there looking, and I was like, "I think those are chanterelles." And you know, and I've got the same picture, this app that you're talking about, and I used it and used some other things. I was like, "Those are chanterelles." And then once you see them, they're everywhere. But it was just about, he saw them first and he's like, "Look at those." And so he and I went and picked a bunch and we brought them home. And, you know, I cooked some. I tried them myself first to make sure that, you know, it wasn't anything crazy. And we even fed them to some friends that came over that were actually vegetarian. Sure. And I had elk, I had deer, and I had, you know, bacon, and I had some different things that we'd grown in the garden, but I had these mushrooms that we'd foraged. And I cooked those up, and even these vegetarian friends that had come over, they were interested. "Where did you get these?" You know, and I was like, "Man, like these, you find these in the store. These are expensive."
Absolutely.
But we, you know, I was like, my son picked all these. And, you know, it was a great opening, because then they were like, "Wow, y'all picked this?" And then, you know, and then we got to talk about the elk and the deer and about, "You hunted this." And, "Oh, you mean like you even ate the liver and you made bone broth and bone marrow and you used all the animal?" And they were very open to that. And I think it's a great entrance way. The whole, you know, I mean, I think of foraging and fishing as a great entrance way to introducing other people to the outdoors, of procuring your own food. And I think what you're talking about is so great. Like the kids are, they see things, and even, I mean, I didn't know that he would even point out a mushroom, you know. But even now, like we walk and he's like, "Dad, that's an evergreen tree." And I'm like, "Is that a cedar or a pine?" He's like, "I think that's a cedar." And I'm like, you're right, you know. And like, and it's funny, like you said, like they're such sponges. And I heard a stat, it was like most adults today cannot name 5 native plants in their area. And, you know, that's sad, if you will. But I think it's really important, like you said, you can use these apps, you can use the community, whether online or in person, to learn about what is there and what we can actually use. And I think that's so, man, your website is amazing with the information. And it also, you take more just, you know, like you said, I like how you break it down into the layman's terms, where I don't need an environmental science biology degree to understand what you're saying. When some people, I think they try to show off how smart they are by using the big terms, but I've seen that those who really are the smart ones, they break it down to where anyone can understand it.
And that's kind of the big takeaway, is that, you know, it doesn't have to be scary. It takes a little bit of research. But if me, a chef, not a botanist, not a mycologist, if I can teach, I thought, you know, if I can teach myself to eat, you know, 100 different types of mushrooms, then, yeah, you know, anyone can do it. And anyone can go out and find free food and feed their family. You know, it's kind of as simple as that.
I love it. You know, and like you said, right now is a time when, you know, people are, you know, $9 for a head of cauliflower, and, you know, there's no meat in the store, whatever it may be. And now is a time that I think a lot of people are wishing they knew how to do that. And, you know, just, and we're these are times, like you said, we never thought we'd see, but they're here right now in front of us.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, and one of the great things that I love about just being in the woods, like you said, foraging and just seeking out these great wild ingredients that you can use in a meal for your family, for your in your restaurant, whatever it may be. It's a lot of activity. There's a lot of walking involved. And other than just walking, what other ways do you use to stay fit and healthy? And how do you see the wild food that you gather playing a positive impact on your health and those around you?
Oh, I mean, that's a great question. So we have really cold winters up here. So my diet and kind of exercise regimen is very cyclical and it's very seasonal. So in the winter, I'm still doing it now. I'll get up and I just do burpees and planks and a couple different things on my floor when it's cold. And I try to do whatever I can inside the house, every day, just as part of my routine. But once it gets warm outside, once I can go outside and especially find things, there's something about finding things too. It's almost like finding money on the ground. It adds another element that when I'm outside, you know, taking a walk, or I need to go hike into the sugar bush to get some wild leek leaves and some other greens to cook or some wood nettles. Now, once the greens start popping, I don't need to exercise in the morning at all. And I switch that up and all of my exercise will come from, you know, the cardiovascular stuff and just walking around for large portions of the day.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, that's the big thing, is just getting outside and getting moving. And, you know, like you said, the burpees, I've always told people when they're talking about exercise, I was like, do a few minutes worth of burpees every morning, and doesn't matter what happens the rest of the day. If something bad happens, you can at least think, man, at least I'm not doing burpees right now.
Yeah, and I do those. I actually had to teach myself to do burpees because I had Lyme disease, and it reacted really bad with a pre-existing condition I had, and I actually had to do burpees in order to make these crazy headaches go away, and getting my heart rate up was the only way to make the pain stop. So I'm pretty used to doing burpees, and there was something that I can do in a very small, confined space that would get my heart rate up and give me a good amount of exercise in a small confined space. In my kitchen, in my apartment, was where I would do a lot of those.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, like you said, I mean, being outside, we do have to face the Lyme disease and things like that, but that doesn't stop us from getting out there and searching. And I love the way you talk about, like, it's that treasure hunt almost. I mean, every Absolutely. Kid wants to be a pirate or draw a map. I know that my kids, they love to draw a map, put an X, and we got to go find something. I don't know what we're searching for sometimes.
We're searching for treasure.
Yes. And, you know, and it's the same thing. I mean, whenever we found those chanterelles, you would have thought, I mean, I felt like I'd struck gold. But, you know, my kids, they were out there picking them, and I was just telling them, like, we were collecting bags, and they just couldn't wait to take them and show the grandparents and show mama all the, you know, the gold that we had. It was just so amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, and you're sharing and passing on this, and you do that through your website, and I'm really looking forward to your book because I know that it's going to have tons of great stuff in it. But as far as getting others involved, I know you said that there's communities, but if we ourselves wanted to try to get others involved, like our kids or just others that maybe we hunt with, that we fish with, that are around us, we want to get them involved in foraging with us. And how would you encourage or invite others to join you and teach them about foraging?
Well, one of my favorite things to do is, you know, I got a lot of friends that hunt, so I like to connect things to people with parts of the season and, you know, outside activities that they already know. So, for example, turkey season is going to be here in the Midwest pretty soon. So, you know, if my friends are out hunting turkeys, you know, a good example is maybe they'll see some morels when they're out turkey hunting. But sometimes they're not going to get turkeys. So I like to say, hey, hedge your bet so that you don't have to ever go home empty-handed. And when you're out there looking for turkeys, you can also look for nettles. You can look for wild garlic. And there's a whole host of different things that you can get when you're out hunting turkeys that you can bring back too. And then, I mean, during the summer when my friends will be out fishing and things like that, then there's a lot more. There's a whole bunch of different greens like milkweed and things like that, and tons of mushrooms in the summer when people are out fishing. But I like to connect it to you know, outside activities that my friends already have and are familiar with as just like, hey, here's an extra thing that we can look for when we're out looking for turkey, fishing, or you know, doing some scouting for deer season. Here's some extra things to sweeten the deal.
Man, I love that. Yeah, just, you know, like you said, it's you're not coming home empty-handed. And I think that's one of the things everybody's always worried about. Like, oh, I didn't get anything. But if you've got something to eat stashed away in your backpack that you found, you know, like you said, like that treasure chest that you found out there of extra mushrooms, whatever it may be, that you're not coming home empty-handed. You still have something to eat and can share with your family.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the greedy human part of me is that when I dedicate my time to something, I don't want to lose. You know, right. I like winning. And when I go out and I'm trying to get food and I'm going to hunt mushrooms, the good example for me, or if I don't get anything in my trap that day and I got this woodchuck I'm trying to get and he's just been kind of wily. I really actually love the woodchuck. It's pretty good. I don't ever have to lose, and I will always come back with something now. That was one of my goals when I started out. I said, hey, I want to be, how cool would it be to be able to go out any time of the year and come back with food?
That's what our ancestors did, and you know, over time we've lost that, and it's
exactly
a shame, it's sad, but we have. You know, and speaking of our ancestors, the one, I'll be honest, one of the things, my favorite parts about your website is you have an organ and awful section. And
absolutely.
And if, you know, for awful, O-F-F-A-L, not A-W-F-E-L, or A-L, I don't know. I'm not a spelling man. But you know, it's like you said earlier, it's an awful name, but it's, you know, on your site, you have that, and you give these unique and tasty ways that we can eat organ meat, you know, liver and, I mean, Rocky Mountain oysters, that we can get this nose-to-tail approach to where we're using more of the animal, and less is in the gut pile, and more ends up on our plate, and it's a delicious, tasty way. And how did you, I mean, I'm sure it may have been through the restaurant, but how did you really dive into the organs and how to cook those and serve those up and make them delicious and not, you know, that, oh, this is liver or gross, you know, that kind of feeling that everybody has, but people can eat something that you fixed up that is an organ and they would love it and they would come back for more. How did you really dive into that, and how can we start using more of a nose-to-tail approach?
Well, that's a good question. So when I was at Heartland, I was running a station on the line when I was sous chef. I had a meat tasting menu. So it was three different dishes based on meat. And the menu for the restaurant, it changed every single day. And it was whatever I wanted to make. So I had control over it. And the only animals we used, we didn't just get a tenderloin. We only worked with whole animals. So eventually, we'd build up big stashes of organs and things in the freezer. And when you're looking at the bottom line, you are going to squeeze out every single penny out of that cow, out of that pig, that lamb or goat. You're going to get everything you can from a chef's perspective, from, like, you know, cost benefit. Everything has to get sold. And it's got to taste good because it's a really nice restaurant. So I would go and talk to the butcher and I'd say, hey, what do we have today? And maybe it was tongue. Maybe it was liver. Maybe it was testicles. Maybe it was something that people probably won't notice, like caul fat, which is a really good thing to take out of deer, you know, or hearts or kidneys, all kinds of things. So that daily changing menu, having a different challenge every single day that often included a lot of different types of organ meats that I had never cooked before. It was a lot of experimentation and just research and old-fashioned work. There's a number of different ways that I would say that you could tip your toes in, because I got a lot of friends, you know, they don't take anything. I mean, not even hearts, tongues, everything goes in the gut pile. And, you know, I can understand that, especially if there's some of my friends like out in Montana, they're in a remote location, they got to pack out the animal. And the organs, they're going to go bad faster than other things. The other thing is that organs, you know, talking about our ancestral diet here, they are far more nutrient dense than other parts of the animal. Along with that, you know, some of them, the organs are doing different things, processing a lot of blood and stuff like that. They have stronger flavors. One of the best ways to get around that is teaching yourself how to make a ham brine. Or how to make a corn, like a corned beef brine. So, like, one of the classic ways that organs are prepared is soaking them in something. So, I mean, for example, obviously you're not going to take these out of deer with CWD, but brains are, and sweetbreads are, those are classically like soaked in milk or salt water. And liver, that you do the same thing with liver, and you soak it in water or salt water or milk for a day. With something like venison liver, I might soak it for a couple days in the fridge, and I might change that water out a few different times. And then, you know, maybe I'm going to grind it into some Braunschweiger for sausage, or I'm going to make pate. That soaking, a lot of those flavors that people think are gamey, the flavors are what we would call water soluble. So the more they soak in water, the more that flavor gets watered down, and it can kind of smooth things out a little bit. But with corning and ham brine, it will completely change the game with different, especially with meats that are, you might think are tough too, like Canadian goose breasts. Mm. These things are tough as nails most of the time. If you put those things in a corn brine or in a ham brine, and then you put them in the smoker for a little while, the brine denatures how the meat is, the muscles are structured. And basically, anything you put in a ham brine, you leave it sit for like a good, you know, typically like 4 or 5 days, and then you smoke it or cook it, it's going to be tender. And it's going to be a lot different than if you would eat that meat fresh. So, hands down, the biggest piece of advice that I have for cooking organ meat to start out is familiarize yourself with how to make a ham brine. And the bonus is that you can then take, you know, a roast out of the leg or whatever you want, and you can use that ham brine for just about anything. I use it for tongue. I use it for heart. I actually have a video online about how to make a corned lamb heart Reuben. And recipes for lamb and goat are really great for venison because they're both small ruminants. So just about, another thing I like to do is if I want a new way to cook venison or something, I still got a freezer pack full of it. I look at recipes for lamb and goat really often, and you can interchange any of those things. A really interesting one that I came across that I've been working on, and I'll get it on the website pretty soon, is a recipe for liver from an old Scottish cookbook that you don't even, the liver isn't used as a meat at all. What you do is you use it to make a condiment, and it ends up tasting a little bit like Worcestershire sauce. it is a cool recipe. So you take it, you cut it into pieces, and you boil it with water and a bunch of salt and seasonings. And then you decant that off and do some other things and strain it, and you use it like you would like soy sauce, essentially. And it's a really old recipe that people would use to make the most out of liver. So, I mean, there's lots of different things that you can do, but by far the easiest way to start out is by making a ham brine and starting to soak some of your organs before you cook them.
Man, that's awesome. Because, I mean, growing up, my grandfather, I remember him talking about, I mean, he would eat, you know, he grew up in the Depression, and I remember him talking about, you know, groundhog, and he was talking about, he's like, well, it tasted pretty green, you know, it was greasy, and I would walk into his house, and he would have squirrel brains and eggs, and I mean, he told me, he said, son, you eat these, and you'll climb up a tree backwards. So I ate some. You know, I mean, I can't tell you how they tasted. I'm sure I smothered them in ketchup or something, but, you know, it was just, you know, I would do it because those are things that are, you know, our ancestors, just one or two generations back, they had to, because they were in times similar to what we are in, you know, with this coronavirus right now, to where there's not a lot of food on the shelf. And it's very interesting times that you go back that far. But I love how you're diving into, you know, even some of these old recipes, and you're finding this stuff, and then you're able to share it with us. And that's probably where you get some of what you're famous for is your taste combinations. And where, you know, I've seen some comments about some of your recipes about how you may mix some things that, you know, for even a chef do not seem like they would go together. And would you just share with us maybe some of your favorite taste combinations and how you may mix those things?
Sure. Well, real quick, I can't help myself. We got to go back to the squirrel brains quick. So just as kind of a PSA, there is definitely a tradition that I know of eating squirrel brains, kind of down where you guys are. And we got to say, absolutely, it is not recommended to eat squirrel brains anymore.
No, it's not.
Yeah. It's yeah. If I remember correctly, it's something similar to CWD, but it's definitely not recommended. But
that could be what's wrong with me right now. I don't know.
But anyway,
I have the brain of a squirrel.
Flavor combinations. I mean, really, I like to cook things that are in season. But I also use a lot of things that I make myself. So it was just maple season here in Wisconsin and Minnesota. So I take maple syrup and then I add some living vinegar that I have, like apple cider vinegar you could get at the store, and I make my own vinegars. Or, you know, I make my own condiments out of wild leek leaves and things like that. And, you know, I don't really use too many, like, pre-prepared condiments. So I definitely say that one of my favorite combinations of flavors is using condiments that I create myself, which could be as simple as I put something up for it's called a salsa verde that's made out of wild leek greens that is really good with any kind of meat or fish or any kind of protein that you'd like. But definitely, flavor combination-wise, condiments that I make are probably the biggest. And then using mushrooms in different ways, because I usually have a lot of mushrooms laying around, enough so that I bake loaves of bread with mushroom flour. Using dried mushrooms as like a crust for meat. Like, my girlfriend can't have flour in her diet. She's celiac. So I'll take lobster mushrooms, which have kind of like an aquatic, like a lobstery flavor, and I dry them and I grind them into powder, and then I crust my walleye with it. Now, that's one of people's favorites. And then we have a lobster mushroom crusted walleye. Those are a couple examples that I like.
And didn't I see you made a mushroom ketchup?
Yeah, so that's another really old recipe, very, very similar to the liver ketchup is the one that I just described. So a ketchup, you know, was not originally made from tomatoes. It was derived from kind of like a Southeast Asian sauce called ketsiap, and that was based on fermented fish. And the Romans made a sauce called garum that was very similar. And it kind of morphed from there into, in Europe, people would make ketchups out of all kinds of things. So I make ketchups out of unripe walnuts is a traditional one that they would do in Britain. Mushroom ketchup is another one. Ketchups made out of different types of fruit, like plums. That's like, you'll see that in like the Caucasus region, like Romania and Georgia and places like that, in the Balkans. Lots of different condiments and things like that. But mushroom ketchup is just one of them. One of the most famous, kind of from the Civil War era.
Man, like my brain is about to explode right now. It's all your information is just amazing. And I think it's really given me a good perspective, maybe all of us a good perspective on, we can look at things differently. Because, you know, ketchup growing up, that's just, you know, pretty much corn syrup and a little bit of tomato, you know, but the way that you're talking about it, man, it's just so different, and that we can just, if we step back just for a moment and allow ourselves a little bit of distance from our food, if you will, and take a little more time with our food, man, we could come up with such good stuff. And I mean, just get on your website, get on your Instagram, and we've got plenty of things we can try, I know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, Chef Allen, I have just a few questions, kind of real quick. What would you say is your favorite wild food to hunt, but also to cook up?
Oh man, that's a tough one. I mean, I want to say whatever the new thing is that I haven't eaten yet.
Nice.
Some of my favorites. There's a mushroom called the matsutake that really, I mean, I can probably name people on one hand that have hunted it in Minnesota or Wisconsin and successfully found matsutake. They're kind of like a holy grail up where I am. Again, look, talking about finding treasure. It's really rare to see in our region. So that's one of my favorites I look forward to. But really, one of my, the thing that I eat the most that we can't forget to talk about is just plants, you know?
Yeah.
just all kinds of leafy green plants are, that's really what I eat the most of.
Man, you know about that mushroom, it's kind of like anybody that finds a little honey hole where they're fishing or hunting. It's like you find that mushroom, you're probably not, most people are probably not going to share it with many folks if it's that rare and hard to find.
You are not going to share it with anyone. And yeah. I mean, I'll tell you, I see on Craigslist here in the Midwest every single year when morel season comes up, people will be trying to auction off morel patches for, I need a new trailer. I need a new boat. I want, you know, X many thousands of dollars, and I will tell you where this morel patch is. So you think about a good honey hole for trout, or your buddy's land that has the really good buck everybody's trying to get. This is the exact same thing. It's the exact same sort of feeling, like I found treasure, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've you know, growing up, we had some friends, and they would go out and dig ginseng and on their property. And even I spent some time in China, and ginseng was the thing over there. You know, that's like the one of the main things that they tried to export, I guess, from the U.S., is a lot of ginseng. And I was really surprised that one of the few questions I got was, do you own guns? Do you know any good ginseng? And do you know where Jack Daniels is? Those are the three questions I got the most while I was in China. It was weird. You know, I was over there working with some high level athletes and stuff. And it was just really interesting. That was the three things they were concerned about, because all their athletes, they gave them ginseng. And that's something that most of us could probably, you know, during the season, we could dig up if we knew where to and how to find it.
Sure.
Yeah. So one of the final questions here is, if you could hunt anything, anywhere with anyone, so who would you be with, where would you be, and what would you be out hunting for?
Oh, man, I got to say, I grew up vacationing in Arizona where my grandparents live, and I know my friend Hank Shaw, if you know Hank Shaw, I know he hunts javelina, and I have always wanted to eat javelina. So I'd say it would be me and Hank in Arizona hunting some peccaries.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So the final question here, Alan, is, what to you is a healthy hunter?
Well, to me, I would say a healthy hunter is someone who can go out and kind of step back and see the big picture of, how do I interact with the environment in a beneficial way that works with nature's natural cycles, instead of, you know, just thinking just ways that is good for humans.
Man, I love that. I mean, because that's what we're all about. We are the first and last line of defense, really, when it comes to taking care of, not only, you know, we think about the animals, but also the land. And it's a cycle where if we destroy the land, we don't have the animals or the fish that we like to hunt and fish. But then again, we don't have the things that we can actually go out. We don't have things to eat. They don't have things to eat. And it's just that cycle. And I think that is a perfect answer. I mean, this is really what it is to be a healthy hunter. It's all about the total health, not only ourselves, but of everything that we're involved with.
Yeah, absolutely.
Man, that you have almost blown my mind with all the information, Alan. I am super impressed. I've seen a lot of your stuff, and I know our friend Brad from over Go Wild, he got us introduced, and man, I've just... He said that you would be the man to talk to about foraging, and about even you were the, you know, when your expertise, like you said, was using nose to tail, and he was not wrong. I'm sitting here, all the things that I could think about that I'm ready to go out and even do a little more foraging now and see what's around the next bend. But man, it's been a wealth of knowledge, information, and very timely for where we are right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, you know, mentally, you know, our go to the store mentality has really been shaken. And I think a lot of people are realizing that. But we've only scratched the surface of what Alan has to offer. And I really encourage you all to dive deeper and learn more. And Alan, just let us know where we can learn more about you, learn about what you're doing, and where we can become better stewards of the land, but also be able to live off the land a little better.
Well, you know, a great place is, I share a lot of info on my website. You can go there and sign up for updates. I send things out typically once a week on Saturdays, but there's a big archive on there of, you know, over 50 different mushrooms and 20-25 different types of different plants, and they're all in kind of quick digestible little articles that you can peruse, with tons of pictures and resources to other things. That's www.foragerchef.com. My Instagram @foragerchef, I kind of share, you know, little quick updates and things like that. Lots of pictures. I love taking pictures. And I share things that are kind of, you know, hyper seasonal there. And a lot of people connect with me there. And my book, Flora, is kind of the vegetable portion of a 3-part series I've been working on, Flora, Fauna, and Fungi. That's going to come out through Chelsea Green Publishing in Vermont in spring 2021, and I'll be announcing all that stuff soon. I'm just getting ready to edit the final copy of the manuscript in probably the next few months here. So I'll be announcing all that through the website. So you can take a look at that, and I'm usually pretty available online for questions and things like that. And don't be afraid to reach out. So that's where you can find me.
Boom. That was amazing. Thank you so much, Alan, for your willingness to share your knowledge and your expertise. That says a lot about just who you are as a man, just being able to share what you know, because I know a lot of people, it's like they're afraid to share some of the things they know, but you've been super open, and it's opened my eyes to a lot of things that I need to be doing more of.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Man, thanks so much, Alan. And as always, stay humble, be hungry, and get healthy.